States Tennis Association has apparently seen enough. Earlier this summer, USTA President Dave Haggerty announced more than $500 million in new courts and improvements to its largest stadium.
Yes, as you've heard, there will be a roof on Arthur Ashe Stadium.
The USTA hopes to have that retractable roof in place by 2017, but for now, defending champions Serena Williams, Andy Murray, and the rest of the field will still have to contend with the weather. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
A Wall Street pioneer died yesterday in New York of complications from cancer. Muriel Siebert started as a trainee earning $65 a week. She became the first woman to own a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. Muriel Siebert was 80. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features with the new thriller Closed Circuit, starring Eric Bana and Rebecca Hall, from the producers of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, in theaters Wednesday.
WILL programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to celebrate the kickoff of El Nora, the Guitar Festival, with the opening night party on Thursday, September 5th at 6 p.m. For more information, visit ElNoraGuitarFestival.com.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. If you've been following the news in the past week, you may have read a lot about something that happened not yesterday, but 50 years ago, and that's the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. This Wednesday marks the anniversary of that march, and it was on a Wednesday in 1963 when the march took place. At the time, some people worried out loud that a large gathering of black people in the nation's capital would lead to violence. In fact, the march brought an estimated 250,000 people to Washington, black and white, for a peaceful demonstration on Washington's National Mall, highlighted by what we now remember as the I Have a Dream speech of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Today we're talking about that march on Washington, the experience of it, and the impact. And on the phone with us today is Bill Smith, Champaign native that some of you may remember as Bill Squirt Smith from the Champaign High School football team from 53 or 54 years ago. But he was a U of I student when he took part in the March on Washington. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us this morning. And I just want to note, a little later on, we'll be bringing in Dr. Sundiata Chajua. He's a professor of history and African-American studies here at the university, to talk some more about the march. But, Bill, I'd like to ask you right now, I gather that maybe a dozen or so people, certainly several people from Champaign-Urbana, went to the March of Washington. Why did you decide to go?
Well, I was talking with Mrs. Bridgewater.
That's Irma Bridgewater, I take it.
Irma Bridgewater, and she indicated that she had a contact that could facilitate several people from Champaign to go to the march, and I took her up on that, and she did the logistics for getting it together, and Bob Butler, who was a contemporary of mine and myself, we traveled with Mrs. Bridgewater, you know, for that for the march. Now, Mrs. Bridgewater and Bob and I had also been involved in 1959. There was a picketing of J.C. Penney's store that was opening in downtown Champaign for discrimination in their hiring practices. And that's how we really got involved with Mrs. Bridgewater, you know, on a more adult peer-type level, and that continued on.
Now, in 1959, you would have still been in high school, right?
That is correct.
So that was really a pretty serious step for you to take at that stage in life.
That was not only a serious step for me to take, it was a serious step for the community to take. I can remember many of the discussions leading up to the picketing about the dangers and the possible downfall of the organization that was being put together to sponsor that particular event.
Now, I'm wondering, by the time of the march, you were a student at the U of I. I understand you were active in the local NAACP chapter?
Yes, the student chapter of the NAACP was the only nationally affiliated civil rights organization in the region. And I became president of the student NAACP and had, you know, the responsibilities of president for helping to decide agenda items and areas that we would be addressing, primarily with the university, since we were a university-based organization.
What were some of your concerns at the time?
Well, we had the university listed, maintained a listing in the housing office for primarily for graduate students, for rental houses in the Champaign-Urbana area. And we took issue with the university providing a listing that included segregated housing units or units that would not rent to people of color. And that was a major campus issue at the time. We also were involved in a review of the admissions policies in the College of Commerce and Business Administration, where there was an informal quota placed on Jewish students in the College of Commerce and Business Administration. An additional area that we were working with at that time happened to be with white-only and Christian-only clauses in the charters for many of the fraternities and sororities that existed on campus. And we took issue with all of the above.
You know, it's strange hearing about these things 50 years after the fact, that this was pretty much a part of daily life back then. What was life like for you? I know everyone's life is different, but were there just some things that you could expect just because of being black in Champaign-Urbana back then?
Well, having grown up in Champaign-Urbana, of course, my experiences went beyond the campus gates. And and growing up in Champaign-Urbana, there were basically de facto segregation in the movies in Champaign-Urbana, where if you went to the movie, you automatically knew the area for seating for blacks, and very seldom was that code ever changed during the time that we were growing up in the area. You just knew what the guidelines were and how far you could go and shouldn't go without being confronted with more direct forms of racism.
And were you in a sense sort of choosing your battles with some of the demonstrations that were held locally, such as the one against JCPenney's?
Well, the demonstrations of that nature were not common in Champaign-Urbana. So the JCPenney's demonstration was the first organized effort to demonstrate against discrimination of any form. And that came about really because a local young lady of color had applied to be a clerk in JCPenney's, and the store's retail outlets at that time had it seemed to have been an agreement, but no one had clerks of color. The only place that people of color were working in downtown Champaign or downtown Urbana were behind the scenes. And this was something that came up at a time when people were confronting racism in many different ways, the freedom rides, the lunch counter sit-ins, primarily in the South. We decided that we'd better do something about the racism that existed right there at home. And so that I look at that as one of the first efforts that were organized to confront racism in the Champaign-Urbana, greater Champaign-Urbana area.
And in the middle of all this, of course, this was a few years later in 1963, was the national event of the March on Washington. Why was that event important to you at the time? What were you hoping to get out of going there?
Well, what we really wanted, we wanted to make contact with people all over the country who were doing things on a local basis. And this was the first opportunity to do something on a national basis, so that the context of what we were doing or attempting to do in Champaign-Urbana would be clearer to us as a part of a much larger problem, or of a problem that was shared by people coming from many different parts of the country. And the awesome thing about the march was that as soon as we arrived and we saw banners from communities all over the country, and this reinforcement that we were not alone, and became very important to us. It was a reinforcement of our commitment that it was not unique, but it was something that had to be a part of a whole to keep the fabric together.
Well, we are talking about the March on Washington here on Focus today with Bill Smith, formerly of Champaign, now living in Ohio, and he was at the University of Illinois when he took part in the March on Washington. We'd be interested in hearing from you. Maybe you weren't at the March on Washington, but maybe you took part yourself in advocating for civil rights in the 1960s or at other times, and we'd like to hear about your experiences. If you have memories to share or questions for our guests, call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And maybe we could bring in our other guest right now, and that's Professor Sundiata Chajua here at the African-American Studies Program at the U of I. And you've looked really at this whole period of civil rights activity. And I just take it there was an awful lot going on in 1963.
Absolutely. But let me first say hello to Mr. Smith and thank him for his memories of the march. Yeah, 63 was an extraordinarily important year. In many ways, I think it's pretty clear that it's the most important year of the civil rights movement. It's the March on Washington, of course, but more importantly, it's the Birmingham campaign that really puts pressure on Congress, puts pressure on the Kennedy brothers to pass and push the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It lays the groundwork for the passage of the 65 Voting Rights Act. It's the year that Medgar Evers is killed. It's the year that Malcolm X leaves the Nation of Islam. It's a year of tremendous violence across the country, particularly in the South. So it's an extremely important year for civil rights, and it's the beginnings, the definitive beginnings of the transition from campaigns for civil rights to what I would call battles for Black power.
Well, in the midst of all of this, how did the March on Washington come to be organized, and what were the goals of the organizers?
You know, that's probably a long story in the sense that the two individuals who organized the 63 March were A. Philip Randolph, the venerable African-American labor leader, and Bayard Rustin, in many ways the tactician to Randolph's initiatives that go back to 1941. In 1941, Randolph and Rustin had organized a march through something that was called the March on Washington movement. And they put a lot of pressure on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Roosevelt responded by issuing Executive Orders 9346 and and basically opening up defense industries to blacks. Therefore, Randolph and Rustin called off the march because they got what they wanted. And over the course of the next 20 years, periodically, there would be a sense that we should march on Washington bubbling up out of the community. So by the time we get to 63, all of that violence that's occurring, right, this thing bubbles from the community, and Randolph and Rustin start planning for a march. And in the context of the violence, particularly in Birmingham, they're able to build a broad coalition that then leads to the 63 March on Washington and that historic event.
Bill Smith, I was wondering, did you have expectations at that time what the March on Washington would mean for national politics and the civil rights movement?
Quite frankly, the answer is no. But I had hopes rather than expectations. And my hopes were that I would and others would feel reinforced in terms of what they were doing on the local level because of the similarity and the relationship it had with what needed to happen on a national level. And so that was reinforced for me, you know, by my being present. Might I say as an aside that, you know, I was also quite taken by the sheer logistics of the march, and that the organizers of the march had a major logistical problem because we were reinforced time and time again about avoiding violence as a part of the march. And as a part of that, the organizers had pretty much struck a deal with Washington, or with the politicians in Washington, that they would, in fact, have the march ended before dusk.
That's right.
So and it was so pretty much a one-day event. You weren't going to be doing any sightseeing.
It was a one-day event not to go into the dark hours.
That's right.
How did you get there?
We went by train from Chicago. We left by train, overnight train to Washington. We arrived at Union Station, immediately walked to the Lincoln Memorial from the station.
How far distance was that?
Wow. It was a nice walk, but at the time we were so excited and there were so many people that it was difficult for me to even estimate, you know, the distance. But what struck me about it was the discipline that the people exercised as a part of the march. And after getting to the reflecting pool, which is about as close as our group could get, we almost heard none of what was actually occurring on the podium.
I was wondering about that because I was reading about the logistics of organizing, which included things like porta potties and loudspeakers, but apparently the loudspeakers were not enough to cover everybody who was there.
Well, this was 1963, and sound systems were not the same as they are today, and we actually did not even know anything about the I Have a Dream speech until we got home and saw it on television.
I was struck by that. From what I gathered, the networks had preempted programming that day to carry the speeches from the March on Washington. This, of course, was in the days before cable television, so you couldn't expect the cable news channels to do it. If anybody was going to cover a breaking event, it was going to be the networks on the various local TV stations around the country. But, of course, you weren't near a TV set when you were out on the mall, so you couldn't
Correct.
Hear.
And it was actually the impact on me and many of the other marchers, I'm sure, was the sheer magnitude of what was occurring and to be a part of that and to contribute to that.
Do you
it meant even more after we realized, you know, the power of the speech and the speeches that occurred on that particular day.
Do you have any memories of meeting people in particular that you spoke with at the march?
No, because it was a the importance, you know, for us was to be a part of what the organizers hope to achieve and not deviate from, you know, this idea of avoiding violence, of being disciplined, of being a part of this tremendous outpouring of feelings about justice for all people. But it was not an occasion for socializing.
You didn't get a chance to
for business.
You didn't get a chance to say compare notes with people from other cities.
The only time we compared notes were basically on the train, going and coming, and it was such a whirlwind trip that we didn't go beyond, you know, those particular contacts.
I'm wondering, once you did see the speeches or read about them later on, did they have an impact on you?
Of course. And the power of them was then and still is overwhelming. And to realize that we played a small part in facilitating that impact by our presence was very reinforcing, and it is something that I obviously will carry with me until the day that I die.
Mm. Dr. Chajua, I'm wondering, was at the time, because I remember, you know, I was a child at the time, I didn't actually hear the I Have a Dream speech, for instance, until Martin Luther King was murdered and TV stations played them all over again. But at the time, was there a large mass impact of what was said at the march beyond just the march itself taking place?
You know, I don't think that people in the various communities heard or resonated with the I Have a Dream speech. I think that the speech became more famous after King's, as we approach King's death, and certainly after the death and the ramp up toward the holiday. At the time, I think it had a greater impact on powerful people, on politicians, particularly the Kennedy brothers. It had an impact inside the movement, but that impact inside the movement was varied. So, for example, in one of the more important autobiographies of the Civil Rights era, Ann Moody's Coming of Age in Mississippi, she talks directly about the I Have a Dream speech, and it led her to leave the movement. She was disgusted with the last third of the speech, the emphasis on, you know, I've had a dream, live freedom. Other people, I think, were galvanized by that speech in particular. So it had a varied interest, reaction to it until the assassination, at which point at least that last third is something that's played over and over. You know, what I would argue is this: very few people read the entire speech, very few people have actually heard the entire speech, and that when you listen to the entirety of the speech, you leave with a very different sense of Martin Luther King, what he represented, and what he spoke to on that particular day.
From what I have read about the speech, the I Have a Dream portion was really sort of added at the last moment. It had been a theme that Martin Luther King had worked on in previous speeches to smaller audiences. But then had decided, noted the cue, the suggestion from Mahalia Jackson, who was nearby, to talk about it, and he went into it then. What was the nature of his prepared remarks?
Well, the prepared remarks you can see in the first two-thirds of the speech, and I guess the salient points would be, first, he talks about the idea that 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, black people are still not free. He then talks about a promissory note, by which he means the extension of democracy. And so he says that black people have come to the nation's capital to cash a check, and the check has come back marked insufficient funds. And then he moves from there to talk about the need to build a strong movement. In his terms, he says that we must not accept the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. In other words, what he's saying is that the Kennedy brothers are trying to put pressure on the movement to do a cooling off period, stop the demonstrations. And Martin Luther King has said, no, we have to continue to put pressure. We have to make the country ungovernable. So he talks about, continuing dissent. He talks about whirlwinds of revolt that will shake the foundations of the nation. And it's that part, that substantive part, that is rarely played for audiences. And we end up with what one could call, one would say the dream as opposed to the plan.
And that was perhaps a little more, might have been considered a little more unsettling to, well, maybe to white audiences at the time, and maybe even some black audiences.
Absolutely.
I'm going to take a call here, and this is Paul from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Since you were just talking about the speech and misinterpretations, I wanted to ask about a book written by, I guess, a UK, Afro-UK guy out of Chicago now, Gary Younge. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. I've been just listening to some talks from him. But the other thing, I'm not sure where I learned it, whether it was from him, was they had a kill switch on the speaker. They would put on gospel music if something untoward was said. I don't know who was deciding that.
Is something like that true as far as you know, Dr. Chachua?
I don't know that for sure, but I also don't doubt it. One of the reasons why King was doing prepared remarks is that the Kennedys had they wanted to control the nature of the demonstration. So every speaker was expected to present a written copy of what they would say and to stick to it. So you have speakers like, say, John Lewis, who has some very critical things to say about the economic nature of the society, the racist nature of the society, where they simply struck those lines. And King made the decision to then depart from the speech. And he's probably the only one that departed from the prepared remarks. So they did have that kind of control. So I wouldn't be surprised if they had a kill speech.
Can I speak to that, the control element? Because it was very obvious that since, for instance, we boarded trains in Chicago to go for an overnight trip. Once we arrived, we immediately disembarked the train and walked to the Lincoln Memorial. After the speeches, we were then taken directly back to the train station, boarded the trains, and left.
That's right.
So that was it. You came there, you went to the march, you left. No sightseeing, no overnights, no going to a restaurant, nothing.
That is correct.
Let's be clear. The military was mobilized and was right outside of Washington, D.C., with the expectation that should something occur, they would be close and ready to act.
Now, I am wondering about that because one of the things, as I was reading some local newspapers from the time of the march, there seemed to be in the news coverage almost a feeling of relief, at least expressed in the reporting, that there would be white people going to the march in Washington. And I'm wondering from the crowds you saw, to what degree was the march integrated, Bill?
I would say one out of four, maybe 25% of the people were white.
Okay. Were there any white folk from the Champaign-Urbana area out there?
None that I knew. Okay. And none that I knew of.
Okay. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be right back with more discussion of the 1963 March in Washington. Wanted to thank Paul for his call earlier before. Also, before I forget, I want to remind you of some special programming tomorrow night, Tuesday night, on our companion station, WYLL-TV, at 7 p.m. In performance at the White House presents a celebration of music from the Civil Rights Movement. Everybody from Smokey Robinson to Bob Dylan are on the schedule. At 8 p.m., the documentary The March, takes a look at the 1963 March on Washington through archival footage and interviews with many of its participants. And at 9 p.m., WYLL-TV will air Building the Dream, telling the story of the building of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall, the mall where the march took place. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus on WYLL continues after this break.
On the next Fresh Air, we kick off Late Night Week. We'll feature interviews with David Letterman, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Questlove of the Roots. We'll begin the week with our TV critic David Biancooley. He'll take us through a history of late night from its beginnings with Steve Allen in The Tonight Show through today. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For over 20 years, Silver Creek has been bringing to the table freshly baked artisan breads, prime steaks and chops, fresh fish and pasta dishes, and pastries made by Silver Creek's pastry chef.
Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WYLL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Did you ever join a group, join a demonstration as part of the civil rights movement? We're talking with someone who did. Bill Smith is a Champaign native who was in college. He was at the University of Illinois when he went out to the March on Washington. That is long enough ago that, Bill, I understand you have just recently retired after many years as an equal opportunity officer at Ohio University at Athens. And also with us today is Dr. Sundiata Chanjua, hasn't retired yet, still an associate professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Illinois. Bill, I was wondering, I wanted to go back to a name that you brought up, and that was Irma Bridgewater. And I know just maybe a couple of weeks ago, there was a memorial street dedicated in Irma Bridgewater's memory. I'm not sure, but I think the Irma Bridgewater Way may be intersecting with John Lee Johnson Way. And John Lee Johnson was another civil rights advocate from the area. Can you tell me anything about Irma Bridgewater?
Irma Bridgewater was a mother, a teacher for several generations of young people that grew up in Champaign-Urbana. From her position as director at the Douglas Center, which was the primary social and recreational outlet for people in northeast Champaign and northwest Urbana, and it's important for people to understand the rigid patterns of housing segregation in Champaign-Urbana up through the 60s. There would be, and so that meant that everyone of color pretty much in the community who were preteens and teens of those of that generation came into contact with Mrs. Bridgewater in her role as assistant director and director of Douglas Center. And she being one of the few people of color, also with a college degree at that time, provided a very high level of conversation and communication for young people who were coming up during those days. And so we knew her from that standpoint, and personally, after the JCPenney, or during the JCPenney boycott, I began to know her more as an adult, because we would sit down and talk philosophy, talk strategy, and she was an open, very informed individual who had a warmth that created a strong bond with all of those that she came into contact with. And I really feel like she's a member of my family.
It sounds like she was a very important mentor to you and perhaps a lot of other people at that time.
Many others. I can't emphasize that enough, that that was an important part of, well, John Lee Johnson, for instance, was one of her mentees, and Roy Williams, another civil rights advocate from Champaign-Urbana during those years. Anyone who was interested in being a part of a movement that was more than personal pretty much had Irma Bridgewater as a part of their resources as they were growing up.
Bill, when you were making plans to go on the march, did you talk to other people about it, and what sort of reaction did you get?
No, as a matter of fact, it was not because there was a small group of people who were considered to be, quote, activists, and that's where the conversation occurred. It was not a general community conversation. Champaign-Urbana was a very conservative community, and the people who were actively involved were many times looked upon as rabble-rousers, even by other people of color. And it was a part of the evolution.
So you weren't going to say to somebody, say somebody in a class saying, well, I'm not going to be here Wednesday, I'm going to the March in Washington.
That wasn't going to happen.
Okay. And it was tricky, and the way you were talking about how rigid some of the residential segregation was in Champaign-Urbana, in reading some of the local newspapers at the time, I'm just struck by the difference in how black people saw things and how white people saw things. One thing I was struck by was an event that happened in that month of August in 1963, where another group, and you can tell me if you have memories of this, the Champaign-Urbana Improvement Association picketed a grocery store, the old Collins Market on Hill Street in Northwest Urbana. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes. The CUIA, as we called it, actually was formed as a part of the JCPenney organization demonstration. It came out of that. Several of the local ministers were involved in the CUIA, as well as the more activist part of the community.
Well, they did have that picket, and apparently they reached some sort of agreement with Collins, according to the news coverage. But a few days after that, the News Gazette ran a letter from I believe it was only signed in the newspaper as a mourner, who was essentially complaining about the picketing and about the demands being made that the Collins supermarket essentially hire black folk as soon as possible, as soon as openings became available. And from the viewpoint of the letter writer, blacks and whites got along fine in Champaign-Urbana, and there was really no problem, and there was really no true separation between them, that they went through trying times like the Depression and World War II together. I take it that must have been a different experience than what you went through, but was, as far as the way white people reacted at the time, was that typical?
That was very typical. And I would say that it's not far from being typical in the black community as well, because the black community in Champaign-Urbana, as in general, was a reflection of the perception of the white community, which was everything is fine and dandy and things are the way that they are because that's the natural circumstance.
I mean, that people had learned how to live with it, Well, what got you in a situation where you were not ready to live with it?
Well, when I guess I was exposed to some of the more progressive thinkers and in the community, and who helped me to understand that things were not in a natural state. That, for instance, in Champaign High School, we had what we called industrial arts classes, which were shops and so forth, where some individuals were steered in those directions rather than taking academic classes. Well, there's nothing wrong with learning a trade, but in Champaign-Urbana, no person of color could be a part of a trade because the trade unions were racially segregated and would not accept people of color into their apprenticeship programs. So there was a difference in the way things were talked than the way they actually were.
Dr. Chajua, I'm wondering here, because Bill just mentioned the certain level of complacency even among black folk at the time. And from what you've seen in the history of the civil rights movement, to what degree did that exist? Because it's certainly possible to have a very rosy view that everybody was marching towards freedom in the 1960s. And when perhaps there was a lot of disagreement on how urgent the cause was.
Well, you know, first I would want to be careful about the terms we use. So when we talk about something like the civil rights movement, we're talking about something that has probably a 20-year run. So we're really talking about something that begins around 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycott, actually probably a 10-year run, and it's over by the time of Martin Luther King's death in 68, and it's probably lost credibility and momentum, particularly with younger blacks, by 65. Mm-hmm. So we want to talk about something called the Black Liberation Struggle, in which case we can then talk about something that begins during the nadir in the 1870s and stretches much further. And in that context, and what I would argue is this, at every moment in history, at every place, somewhere, at every place in the country, there are groups of black people who are not happy with the situation, who are engaged and actively struggling against it. Now, what makes a movement, right, is when you get that discontent that's always there bubbling, that ocean of discontent, that when it bubbles up in terms of enough individual episodes that it begins to crystallize and galvanize into a movement wave. So we think about the civil rights movement as one of those peak moments in which there's a wave. We think of black power as a moment when there's a wave. We think of the 1920s as a moment when there's a wave. So the one thing I would take issue with Mr. Smith is this. I don't think the black people ever were accepting of the situation. It was simply a matter of how the forces were aligned. You know,
and I should say that I brought up the word complacency. So that would be my fault for using that word.
Right. Well, what I want to speak to is that I think one could say that the white working class in this country is dominated by hegemony, meaning that they accept that the politics, the policies of America are correct. I don't think black people have ever believed, meaning a majority of black folks, that the way in which the United States functions is right. But I think there's a matter of whether or not they believe they could make effective change.
And there's something.
And so there's only moments, right, when you have the resources and you have the leadership and you had the social and cultural capital to put together a movement that can transform the society. And what we see is that when those moments emerge, you see a galvanization of the African-American community. But there will be lulls. There will be moments when there will be just a few activists who are out there fighting the battle. But as soon as they begin to pick up some victories, you will see the people rush. And that's when you get that movement wave. And so I would never argue that there's complacency. What I would argue is that people have yet to have a sense of political efficacy. They don't believe that they can make change.
But something happened. But events in 1963 may have brought a larger group of people together, maybe from different currents, but who came together in seeing this possibility that they could, that brought them together.
Absolutely. You know, the events in Birmingham, which was the most violent city in terms of race, for Martin Luther King to unleash wave upon wave in that city, including sixth graders, and to see the dogs and the fire hoses, that galvanizes people. There's been studies that point to the murder of Emmett Till as something that galvanized activism on the part of African Americans. And you can in part trace the Montgomery bus boycott. It comes 3 or 4 months after Emmett Till's murder. So there's these moments where people are galvanized. And I think that's how we have to talk about movements, you know, how they rise from the discontent. But you need shrewd leadership. You need resources to begin to organize people and push it forward.
Well, we're talking about the 1963 March on Washington here on Focus and WYLL with Dr. Sundiata Chachua of the University of Illinois and Bill Smith, the University of Illinois alum who went on the March on Washington. And Bill, I'm wondering, we've been talking about the march and what led up to the march. In this last 5 minutes that we have time here, what happened after you came back, and how did what was the impact on the march and what happened then?
Well, I want to first of all say that I'm in substantial agreement with the good doctor with regard to his analysis of movement. When we were able to do as a result of the March on Washington is more closely identify what was going on locally with what was happening in a much broader context. After having seen and been with, you know, people from all over the country and who had similar motivation for justice and equality, that helped to reinforce myself and others that what we were doing on the local basis, you know, had merit far beyond what its impact would be on a local basis, and therefore was a recommitment.
So you didn't feel
the struggle that we were involved in.
You didn't feel as isolated as you may have felt before.
Correct. Correct. And less likely to evaluate what we were doing and the results of what we were doing strictly on what the immediate circumstances were, because we could see them through a different lens in a different context.
I know just a few months after the March on Washington, President John Kennedy was assassinated, and his successor, Lyndon Johnson, made a real push for the Civil Rights Bill, which Kennedy had advocated for but didn't seem to be getting anywhere. And it was only, I guess, the next year that the bill was actually passed and became law. And that had been one of the goals of the March on Washington, one of the stated goals, passage of that bill.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And how dramatic was that at the time
It was extremely dramatic, mm-hmm. In that there was immediately a sense that our voices are being heard and that something is being done to try and correct many of the inequities that we are subjected to on a daily basis. But it didn't take very long to figure out that the 64 Civil Rights Act in and of itself was not enough. It reinforced in a real positive way the sense that what we were doing was helping to accomplish something, but on a practical basis that this was not in and of itself going to be enough. And that's why, you know, in 64 we had, you know, was the Civil Rights Act, but to get the Civil Rights Act implemented in a meaningful way, it took more executive orders like Executive Order 11246 and other, you know, to really get some meaningful action out of the legislation.
In the years since, have you talked much to other folks about being at the March on Washington? Talked to your own family members, your kids?
No.
Why not?
Not directly. Because for me, the March on Washington was one of many steps. As you know, the doctors has indicated. I mean, we had when Emmett Till's was killed from. There were just so many incidents and events that occurred in addition to that, that the March on Washington, albeit that it's, you know, an iconic circumstance and is known by everyone, it really is a culmination of many, many individual events that were occurring throughout the nation. And I haven't had a lot of conversations trying to make the March on Washington more than it really was, because it's the result of many small marches, and I respect all of those small marches.
Well, Bill Smith, I wanted to thank you so much for talking to us about the March on Washington and the role that it played, in our nation's history. And I wanted to give the same thank you to Dr. Sundi Adichajua, here of the University. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today. You can find more information about the March on Washington linked to our page for this program. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on that website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, Mike Pritchard is our technical director today, and he's been handling the calls. Tomorrow on Focus, we look at how comics, despite whatever you may have heard, can be used as a positive educational tool. Our guests in this encore broadcast are Josh Elder, president of Reading with Pictures and editor of the Graphic Textbooks series, and University of Illinois Library Science professor Carol Tilley. That's on Tuesday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, there's a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580, online at will.illinois.edu, and also at our website you can listen to past programs and sign up for our free downloadable podcast at will.illinois.edu/focus. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. For over 96 years, generations of farmers have turned to Farm Credit for their financial needs. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit offers products and service geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where USDA today has released its weekly export inspections for corn. The export inspections were reported at 12 million bushels. That's below the 24.6 million needed this week to stay on pace with USDA's demand projection of 715 million bushels for the year. Soybean weekly export inspections were 2.5 million bushels. That's below the 3.4 million bushels needed this week to stay on pace with USDA's annual demand projection of 1.315 billion bushels. Weekly export wheat export inspection bushels, though, were pretty bullish at 31.2, and the weekly average needed is 20.01 million bushels to stay on pace with USDA's annual projection of 1.100 billion bushels. But really, today it's all about the weather. Hot and dry conditions this week have the market bulled up and trading much, much higher, double-digit increases all across the floor at CME Group. December hard red winter wheat is 7.18, up 20 and 3 quarters. Soft December wheat is 6.70 and a quarter, up 24 and a quarter. September corn, 5.13 and a half, up 18. December, 4.97 and a quarter, up 27 and a quarter. September soybeans, 14.25 and a quarter, up 60. November, 13.85 and 3 quarters, up 57 and 3 quarters. September soybean meal, 457.60, up 24.40. September soybean oil is 44.65. It is up 201. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. It's now 11 o'clock Central Time.